From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 59 years ago today, Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists conducted the world's first test of an atomic bomb. Tonight, all classified research at Los Alamos is shut down. The disappearance of two computer data storage devices at the heart of America's nuclear weapons research establishment has brought operations to a temporary halt, and it is far from the first security breach at the historic laboratory. In 1999, allegations flew at Los Alamos in the Wen-Ho Lee spy case. In 2000, computer hard drives went missing, only to be mysteriously found later behind a copy machine. In the last 8 months, there have been three publicly announced security lapses. For 61 years, Los Alamos has been managed by the University of California. Now, that contract and the certainty of national nuclear security are under a cloud. Los Alamos critics are saying, enough. Tonight on Point, missing data, security breaches, and the trouble at Los Alamos. We begin with Key Davidson, science writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. I asked him to describe what's happened at Los Alamos.
Well, at Los Alamos, they've had problems brewing for about 2 years, and that originally began with financial, managerial, and security scandals, and that have begun to peak recently with the revelation that they've recently lost two computer data storage devices that are called CRIMs. And CRIMs are computer data storage devices that can be transferred from one place to another, and they can range from floppy disks and zip drives all the way up to hard disk drives, depending on your definition.
Really anything that could electronically hold this sensitive nuclear weapons information.
That's right, and with today's high-density data storage techniques, you can store a great deal of information on these, including nuclear weapons information. And what's happened is that last week, the Los Alamos Laboratory announced late in the day that they had lost these two CRIMs. They were looking for them, and now they're entering, I think it's the eighth day since then, and they still can't find them. They are almost literally turning the laboratory upside down trying to find them. And what makes this particularly ominous to those of us who have covered the labs is that in the past, we've been able to find out what the basic contents were of missing data storage devices. For example, the last time they lost a CRIM, I was able to find out that it contained information on high explosives. Mm-hmm. This time, they are absolutely resolutely refusing to reveal the contents. And that's what makes this particularly ominous, because naturally it raises people's deepest possible fears and suspicions.
You're writing in the San Francisco Chronicle today that in the worst-case scenario, secret information could fall into the hands of enemies of the United States, which might describe super weapons or information on these disks on chemical explosive thermonuclear bombs capable of vaporizing cities.
Possibly. Again, I want to emphasize this is all speculation.
That's right.
They won't tell us what's actually on it. And I don't want people to become unduly alarmed. It may well be that they'll discover the things today or over the weekend. But at the moment, the University of California Regents just went into meltdown yesterday when they heard testimony from the director of Los Alamos Laboratory, Pete Nanos.
Now, describe that relationship. You describe the Regents as apoplectic, but remind us what they have to do with Los Alamos.
The University of California has run Los Alamos Laboratory, Nuclear Weapons Laboratory, and Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratory for approximately a half century, and it does it under contract to the U.S. Department of Energy, which oversees the whole U.S. nuclear weapons complex. Therefore, the University of California Regents are nominally the people who control Los Alamos and Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratories.
And they are already under the gun because Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, who's in charge of all of this in the U.S. government, is putting oversight of these labs out for bid next year because of what he's described as systemic mismanagement by University of California of Los Alamos, Livermore, and so on.
Yes, that's right. Sometime back, he decided that there were just too many scandals and that the lab could no longer be entrusted to one controlling party, the University of California, and so he's putting it out to bid. And the University of California Regents have not yet formally decided whether they're going to compete for the next contract. I think they would like very much to compete, but I think, one, they're afraid of a humiliating loss of the lab contract to some outside entity, say a think tank like Battelle or a corporation such as Lockheed Martin or possibly the giant University of Texas academic system, which would love to get it. And second, because the state of California is in financial meltdown. There's not a lot of money around in order to fund a campaign to compete for the Los Alamos contract.
You described one of the regents yesterday, Richard Bloom, calling this latest scandal like a stab at your heart, saying this lost material is among the most sensitive intelligence material we have in the nation. They're just blowing their stacks out there.
They really are, and Richard Bloom is a man who normally doesn't do that. He's the husband of U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. He's a well-spoken, thoughtful fellow, and, you know, he just doesn't normally talk like that. At the past meetings of the regents that I've covered, I've never heard such language, ever. Ward Connerly, who is one of the more conservative figures and controversial figures, for other reasons, on the UC regents, said that one part of him wanted to just say, fire everybody and get rid of the labs. But then he quickly added, obviously we can't because it's in the national interest to keep these labs in the hands of the best scientific people, and he feels that those are people at University of California Laboratories.
Most Americans, all Americans I suppose, know about Los Alamos as the site of the first atomic weapons production in World War II.
That's right.
What's been going on since then, and remind us of the drumbeat of scandals and suspicion there's been about lost information there in recent years.
Over the last couple of years, there have been security issues at all of the nuclear weapons laboratories. There are three main nuclear weapons laboratories, Los Alamos, Livermore, and Sandia Laboratory, which is in New Mexico and also has a Livermore, California office. And Sandia is being sucked into this because today Sandia just announced that they have a missing disk, although they say it does not contain nuclear weapons information. So security scandals have been going on for years and years at all of the nuclear weapons laboratories. What makes it particularly disturbing right now is, one, the United States is in a war. Second, the CIA has a lame duck manager who is between directors. And third, the nuclear weapons laboratories are prime advisors to the U.S. government in the event of any kind of high-tech terrorist attack on the United States. And since Los Alamos has announced they are freezing all classified research, it does make you wonder if some of the top people who might be required to give their expertise in the event of a terrorist attack are just going to be preoccupied with other things. It catches the country in a very uncomfortable situation if, as Tom Ridge and those people claim, we really are due maybe this year for a terrorist attack.
And how does the National Nuclear Security Administration factor into all of this? Spencer Abrams, the Energy Secretary,
right,
sent out the head of that administration, Linton Brooks, with a team to personally oversee the probe into this latest lost data. What's their role? How do they factor in?
They basically oversee the nuclear weapons complex, which is still huge and sprawling. It involves not only the nuclear weapons scientific labs, Los Alamos and Livermore, and the assembly lab, Sandia, but also many other laboratories that do nuclear-related work, much of it civilian, non-weapons work. NNSA, as it's called, is sort of the umbrella organization that oversees the nuclear weapons complex.
And what kind of research is going on into nuclear weapons, super weapons, at Los Alamos these days? What could be on those disks?
Anything you can imagine, conceivably, because they won't tell us what's on the disks, it's really completely open to your imagination. I was very surprised, frankly, that they didn't try to clarify what was on the disks, because by doing that, they invite all kinds of wild speculations. I want to emphasize again, it's perfectly possible that what's on those disks is somebody's laundry list, but by not saying what's on them, it leaves the public's imagination to the worst possibilities. This is a pretty nervous time, right? And many people will expect the worst.
And, of course, it looks like not just the public this time. You've got Spencer Abram and many others just thoroughly steamed about this latest loss.
Oh, yeah. I mean, heads will roll. Someone's heads, Lord knows whose heads will roll, but heads will definitely roll because of this.
Key Davidson, thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you for asking me.
Key Davidson is science writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. He spoke with us from San Francisco. We're talking tonight about the security breach at Los Alamos, the nation's premier nuclear weapons research laboratory. If the country's oldest nuclear research center can't keep track of its data, how safe can America's nuclear secrets be? After years of uproar and scandal, why can't Los Alamos get it together? And can you imagine what might be at stake if it does not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Leesburg, Virginia, is Peter Stockton, senior investigator at the Project on Government Oversight. He was special assistant to former Department of Energy Secretary Bill Richardson under Bill Clinton. As a troubleshooter on physical and cybersecurity in the U.S. nuclear weapons realm, he was, for 22 years, an investigator for the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Good evening and welcome, Peter Stockton.
Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Peter Stockton, you at your group, Project on Government Oversight, have been pretty tough on Los Alamos and the other labs. I see you quoted here saying, if it was up to you, you'd fire the contractor, University of California. You say this has gone on too long. They should be terminated immediately, like Thursday, like Friday, and have somebody else run it. What's going on at Los Alamos?
And not completely an intemperate remark. In terms of the cybersecurity problems that they've had, as you pointed out in your lead-in, the Wen-Ho Lee debacle, and I'm not arguing that he was a spy, but a lot of classified information left the laboratory at that time. And after that, we got assurances that, oh, this could never happen again because they have a fail-safe system. Then, boom, the two hard drives disappear in 2000. The ones that were found behind the copying machine about a month later, and again, we're assured that everything is fine. Fail-safe system never can happen again. And then we had these three incidents in the last 8 months, and it's just gone on too long. It's not only the cybersecurity problem that that we've had at Los Alamos particularly, but we've had serious physical security problems. There's a particular site there that can't be defended, and they refuse to, or they've slow-rolled the secretary on trying to de-inventory the site. It has tons of highly enriched uranium and plutonium, and it's in a canyon. And as you know from cowboys and Indians, the guys that have the high ground are the ones who generally win, and the bad guys would have the high ground in this situation.
Firing down or attacking from canyon walls, you're saying?
Yes, exactly, and kill anybody that moves and any vehicle that moves.
So what's going on? We're reading about the Los Alamos chief, Peter Nanos, who was brought in to fix this. Reading the Riot Act to his staff there, telling the regents at the University of California, I've drawn a line in the sand, I've chewed them out. And then we hear David Kestenbaum, the NPR reporter, with a source, unnamed, saying that he's reaming them for a cowboy attitude. Why don't things just get in order? Is there a cultural problem of some kind?
You almost feel sorry for Nanos after a while. He's from the nuclear Navy. And when you give orders in the Navy, you expect people to follow them. And, he's been relatively tough during this period of time. But I am so sick of hearing about the culture problem. You know, we've heard about this from the 70s into the 80s, into the 90s. The president's pithy ad, right after the Wen-Ho Lee debacle, the president had his Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board do an investigation.
This is President Clinton.
And they pointed out that with this kind of culture, you really have to get rid of that kind of culture if you're going to run a laboratory like this. And everything that they said in 1999 is absolutely true today.
But what is that culture? We heard there's this fear. It's an academic culture now, I guess. Is there something ingrown there?
I think there's just a level of arrogance. Allegedly these guys, and I don't argue that they aren't smart guys, that, the bomb designers and the others there. And they just feel like, they want to design bombs and they want to do it as loosely as possible, and safety considerations and security considerations just aren't high on their list of things to abide by.
And now we've got a source telling NPR's David Kestenbaum that it is not bomb plans. Of course, there are many other sensitive things it could be. What's your guess? A laundry list? Nothing? Or something serious here?
We don't know. I mean, we've heard speculation that it really, when they went to get those disks, and there were four disks missing.
Mm-hmm.
There were two hard drives missing. And Nanos pointed out today, I guess, or yesterday, that he was as concerned about those as anything. A guy just simply took the two hard drives, walked out, didn't sign out, put them in his pickup truck, and drove off to another site. And they were really concerned about those, but they found them in within the 24-hour limit, they claim, so they didn't have to report it to the Department of Energy.
But two more are still at large.
But the two other ones are still at large. That's true.
Peter Stockton, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about a lockdown at Los Alamos this week, another security crisis at America's premier nuclear weapons research lab. What is wrong with Los Alamos? If America's oldest nuclear weapons lab can't keep track of its research data, how secure can America's nuclear secrets be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the latest security breach at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the nation's premier nuclear weapons research facility. The lab has been plagued with security lapses for years. The most recent has flared up since 1 week ago when two computer storage devices were reported missing. Yesterday, all classified research at Los Alamos was halted. Authorities are not saying what is in the missing data. Earlier, I spoke with Republican Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut, chairman of the House Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations. This spring, his subcommittee held hearings on the terrorist threat to radioactive materials being stored at nuclear facilities around the country. I asked him why Los Alamos keeps running into security problems.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, but none of them are good reasons. We have too many facilities. A lot of them are old. We have too many buildings. We have too many nooks and crannies. And we need to be doing some consolidating. The storage facilities need to be consolidated, the labs and so on. And, you know, this is just, it is alarming because we're talking about the potential for understanding how to make nuclear weapons. It doesn't get worse than that.
Why aren't authorities revealing what has been lost or misplaced or stolen, we don't know, on these disks or electronic storage units that are missing right now? Why the silence?
Well, one, they may not want you to know.
Clearly.
I'm not saying that's for a good reason. I mean, one of the things that I think the September 11th Commission is going to tell you is that too much stuff is classified, and usually it's classified just to protect people from embarrassments. It may be that they simply don't know, which would also be very embarrassing. But the bottom line is, at least we know that there was this breach. That's at least better than not knowing that.
Is there a cultural problem at Los Alamos? Is there something wrong in the culture of the place that's just gone off the rails?
Well, I don't think it's just Los Alamos. I mean, I think Los Alamos is a pretty fine facility and a lot of dedicated people. But the bottom line is, we simply have too large operations in too many different places. And I mean, I could speak to it in terms of being able to detect from a terrorist threat. We have the need to begin to consolidate and have a better sense of what we have and do a better job of controlling what we have.
Are you suggesting Los Alamos ought to be shut down?
I'm suggesting that there are some buildings in some of these. First off, some sites should be, and I wouldn't pretend which one. I'm not suggesting Los Alamos should be shut down, but what I am saying is, for instance, when you go to Y-12,
Y-12 being
in Tennessee, you end up with hundreds of buildings, and you give, if terrorists break in, you give them places to hide. You just begin to wonder how easy it is to keep track of what you got. I consider them like a messy desk. You know, you just got too many buildings, too many nooks and crannies. I think things should be clearer and more obvious and easier to know if it's you know, under lock and key.
Is there a real risk, as we speak tonight, that American nuclear weapons materials or critical research could fall into the hands of terrorists, into the hands of enemies of the United States?
Oh, I always make that assumption. I mean, I make the assumption that those things could happen. And they shouldn't, but that they could. So, now, I don't know in this instance if they have.
We'll hope not. But
let me just say this to you. I mean, my committee, my national security subcommittee, we visited these sites, and we were looking at them more from the standpoint of how you protect from literally a physical attempt by terrorists to take over. Used to be the drill was, well, they had to get in and out, steal the stuff. But, you know, it became very clear all they have to do now is get in because they don't care if they go up with it. And so you began to look at the site and say, my gosh, are there no clear lines of fire? There's too many places to hide and. And we just simply, you know, aren't in the kind of production level that we were before. So why are we keeping all these facilities open? No good reason.
Congressman Shays, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Republican Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut, he spoke with us from Bridgeport, Connecticut. You can join our conversation tonight. With all the money and effort spent on national defense, why can't the country's most sensitive weapons research lab be kept secure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. I've been joined from Leesburg, Virginia tonight by Peter Stockton. He's senior investigator on the project on government oversight. We're joined as well now from Oakland, California by Ian Hoffman, staff writer for the Oakland Tribune, covering science, technology, and the Department of Energy's national laboratories. He is co-author with Dan Stober of the San Jose Mercury News of A Convenient Spy, Wenho Lee, and the Politics of Nuclear Espionage. Ian Hoffman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Bob. Tom.
And in the studio with me tonight in Boston, Matthew Bunn, Senior Research Associate at the Project on Managing the Atom at the Belfer Center at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. He's a former advisor to the Office of Science and Technology Policy under President Clinton, where he helped create policies on weapons-usable nuclear materials in the U.S. and former Soviet Union. Matthew Bunn, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Hoffman, first to you, how do you assess what's going on this week in Los Alamos? You described in the Wenho Lee case what you then called a kind of, you said the country was locked in a game of one-upmanship, describing Lee's crime. This is Congress and the media describing Lee's alleged crimes in more and more superlative-laden rhetoric. So as you watch this week, is this much ado about nothing, or do we have a serious problem at Los Alamos?
Well, you know, if we look at losing two pieces out of, I think what they're down to now is about 12,000 pieces of this stuff they call CREM, this classified removable electronic media.
Fancy name, but it could floppy disk, CD, zip drive, anything like that.
Yeah, in this case, I think there are a couple of zip drives. But, you know, it also includes, as Peter was telling you earlier, maybe removable hard drives. Mm-hmm. In a lot of classified areas of the laboratory, they actually remove the hard drives from their computers and lock them up in safes at night.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, so these are two pieces. And just to, you know, give you a little more background on this, this occurs in a portion of the laboratory that does primarily explosives testing. It's called the Dynamic Experiments Division, the DX Division. And they're kind of out on the lab's back 40. They're out in the kind of the middle of nowhere. And these guys actually worked in a kind of a remote facility that, unlike most of the rest of the laboratory, a lot of offices, they have two sets of computers in their offices, one for the open network that has connections to the internet, and one for the red or secure network that is supposed to be air gapped, no connections to the outside world.
Okay.
But these guys apparently aren't wired up for the red network, and so they do all of their classified computing on this stuff, on this CREM, essentially classified disks and zip drives and things like that. So this is what they're doing day in, day out, and chances are it has to do with either explosives formulations or this organization also runs what they call the dual-axis radiographic hydrotest facility, DART, which allows them to kind of get these three-dimensional X-rays, if you will, of implosions of fission triggers for nuclear weapons, plutonium cores.
Right. It's high science, and you describe it calmly, but of course everyone's nightmare scenario is this kind of super sophisticated weapons research just walking out the door and into the hands of who knows who, Pakistan, China, somebody in the terror network. Is that paranoid to imagine that? Is it more likely just in somebody's glove compartment in their pickup?
No doubt. There's some risk involved there. But, then, you know, the two countries that they just named, I mean, they have nuclear weapons programs.
Espionage programs. In China's case, we heard a lot about that a few years ago.
Espionage programs. I mean, but the point is, frankly, from my end, I'm a little more worried about the things that Matthew's worried about the potential loss of materials. I think that poses constitutes more of a linchpin, if you will, for obtaining a nuclear capability than the kind of the blueprints, if you will, or the designs to a nuclear weapon. Given enough nuclear material, there are a wide array of individuals who could build a bomb for you.
Let's turn to Matthew Bunn here with me in the studio in Boston. Matthew Bunn, how do you look out on all this? As Ian says, you're more focused on the material, and of course you've got these billiard ball-sized plutonium pits thousands and thousands of them at Los Alamos, Livermore, and elsewhere, and outside the United States. When you look at the security alarm this week and you hear the kind of language we're hearing in California, in Washington tonight, around the country, what do you make of it?
Well, we clearly have a significant security problem at the Department of Energy facilities that have the nuclear weapons materials, the nuclear weapons themselves, the nuclear weapons information. But that's really one small part of a much more dangerous and frightening situation around the world. Frankly, the United States, for all its difficulties in security at these sites, spends more and has higher standards for security at these kinds of facilities than any other country in the world. We put out a study very recently where we tried to look at where are the most urgent dangers in terms of potential bomb material that might be stolen and fall into terrorist hands. And we said basically the three highest priorities are Russia, which still has huge stockpiles of both nuclear weapons and materials, security that basically collapsed when the Soviet Union collapsed and has gotten better since then but is still in bad shape, and huge threats with terrorists actually carrying out reconnaissance at nuclear weapons storage facilities in Russia. Pakistan, which has much smaller nuclear infrastructure, heavily guarded, but
it's become the Walmart of nuclear
exactly.
materials.
We've seen that both the insiders marketing nuclear technology around the world, including actual bomb designs, you know, the worst of what might be on this hard drive has already been in the hands of middlemen who've been marketing it all over the world.
Well, but is that true? If this is more sophisticated American designs, wouldn't the Pakistanis themselves even like to get a hold of sort of the cutting-edge American nuclear weaponry design?
Certainly, hostile states would like to get hold of more advanced weapons designs, but the bottom line thing that can incinerate a city is any kind of a nuclear bomb.
Of course.
And the Pakistanis already have that. And from a terrorist point of view, it's much more interesting to have a simple, crude device that they might actually be able to make.
So Russia, Pakistan.
And then third, civilian research reactors. For believe it or not, at civilian facilities, many of them at university campuses, more than 100 of them in more than 40 countries around the world are still using highly enriched uranium as their fuel, which is the easiest material in the world for terrorists to make nuclear bombs from. Many of these facilities have no more security than a night watchman and a chain link fence. Most of them don't have enough material for a bomb at one site, but some of them do, and some of those that do don't have much security.
So practically doors wide open elsewhere, relatively speaking, but still you'd like security to begin at home.
Absolutely. We need to have better security within the Department of Energy complex. We need to do three things. We need first get this stuff into a smaller number of places. You can buy more security at lower cost if you're defending fewer places.
Okay.
And we particularly got to get it out of the places that are hard to defend, like the site at Los Alamos that Paul was talking about. Secondly, we got to increase the standards so that these places are required to be secured against the kind of threats that terrorists and criminals have already shown that they can pose, and we got to test them regularly to make sure they can meet those standards. And then thirdly, we got to take on this security culture, which is not just a Los Alamos problem. It's a problem at facilities all across the country and all over the world. People at facilities, at nuclear facilities, basically don't believe terrorists are going to attack a nuclear facility. They basically don't believe terrorists could make a nuclear bomb if they did get a hold of nuclear material. They basically don't believe that it's as urgent as many of the rest of us feel that it is. And as long as that's true, we're not going to have good security.
May need an attitude adjustment. We're talking about a lockdown on research at Los Alamos this week. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hello. I agree with what Congressman Shea's point he was trying to make, that there's just so many sites. You know, just a few miles away from Los Alamos, you have 25,000 researchers working at Sandia.
This is the nuclear assembly facility.
And then you have 7,000 more at the Air Force Weapons Lab, which is about 3 or 4 miles from Sandia.
Okay.
Sandia is another weapons lab, not an assembly
facility.
Okay,
excuse me.
Right.
Yes, Scott, please go on, Scott.
I worked at the Air Force Weapons Lab for a few years in the mid-70s, and I used to have to go to the airport to pick up digital tape data from Los Alamos for tests that we were sharing.
Yeah.
There was no ID check. Nobody checked to see who I was. I was just standing there.
They just handed you the tape.
They took the handcuffs off one guy, put it on my wrist, and off I went.
Did you ever get an urge to fly to Moscow, Scott?
No offers were made.
Good thing, too.
But, you know, at the end of each day, and these are largely civilians, There was a, even at the Air Force Weapons Lab, it's the lion's share of civilian scientists. They don't have the pressure or the feeling about the security. In fact, I don't think the military did either. We were going to be the security officer that day. And our job would be, this is during the Cold War, but right. Our job would be to walk around and see if we could see restricted information on people's desks or work areas. These are mainly physicists and, mm-hmm. and scientists. They're mm-hmm. not worried about that kind of thing. It just doesn't occur to them.
It's just not front and center on their minds. Scott, we appreciate the firsthand report, and thanks for calling in with it. Peter Stockton, there's an observation from the 1970s U.S. nuclear complex. Mm-hmm. How much better, and especially post 9/11, is that security today?
I'm not sure it's a whole lot better than it was prior to 9/11. One of the concerns that Congressman Shays has been a hero in this. He held a hearing, as he mentioned a month or two ago, and a good deal of it was on improvised nuclear devices, and that's become a major concern of the Congress as well as the weapons program.
And what does that mean? A crude nuclear weapon?
Where the terrorists can get in and within minutes can create a nuclear detonation.
Oh, at one of these sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right at the site. And one of the concerns, I mean, obviously at Livermore, if something like that happened, it'd make a mess out of the Bay Area.
Describe where Livermore is exactly for those who don't know the Bay Area.
It's just east of the Bay Area.
And it's got suburbs practically right on top of it now.
That's one of the problems with protecting it, as Ian knows very well. There are certain weapons that they can't use there because of the proximity of the neighborhood.
Yeah, you have a laboratory where, frankly, if you really want to repel an attacking team, some of the folks on the defending force would like to have things like a 50 caliber sniper rifle or 30 caliber machine guns, things that, frankly, don't mix well with the neighborhood.
But Congressman Shays is saying you could have terrorists come right into these facilities and essentially set off the bombs that are already sitting there.
Well, it's a realistic concern. It's not going to be an easy thing for them, but if you're a suicidal terrorist, frankly, I'm not sure you care that much. And I'm not sure that the Department of Energy's projections on the size and the fervor of an attacking force are adequately model the kind of thing that we saw on 9/11. And I think that's probably what you ought to be prepared for. And just coming back to one of your earlier issues, I mean, this is a kind of an unforgivable thing at Los Alamos. I mean, the laboratory's been down this road before, and this is kind of Groundhog Day, Los Alamos style.
A time to be done with that. We've got to take a short break. Ian Hoffman, Peter Stockton, Matthew Bunn, please stand by. We're talking tonight about a lockdown at Los Alamos this week, another security breach at America's premier nuclear weapons research lab. You can join our conversation tonight. 50 years ago tonight, the United States owned nuclear weapons, essentially alone. Could the staff at Los Alamos then imagine the world of proliferation we live in now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a lockdown at Los Alamos this week, another security breach at America's premier nuclear weapons research lab. You can join our conversation after years of uproar and scandal. Why can't Los Alamos get it together? Could we wake up one morning and find an enemy at nuclear weapons research parity because of American security lapses? What is the solution for Los Alamos, for American nuclear security? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barbara is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling actually to question your question. You're questioning the culture at Los Alamos, and I'm saying, what about the culture of deterrence? What kind of a crazy policy is it that we fund these labs to build bigger and better weapons that can't be used, that the weapons, even of the size of the one we used at Hiroshima, would make 9/11 look like nothing?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we ought to rethink our entire policy. Yes, I'm an hysterical woman. I know that.
Nobody's saying that. In fact, we've got UC Regents saying yesterday, maybe we should get rid of this lab, close it down.
Not just Los Alamos, everything. What do we need these weapons for? They're not good in a war like Iraq. They're not good in any war we've waged in the past 50 years. And we continue to build them and to develop a whole culture of scientists who are trained to make bigger and better bombs.
Barbara, it's a reasonable and straightforward question. Let us pick it up. And thanks for calling in with it. Matthew Bunn, what do you say to that?
Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think that over the long term, we need to fulfill the commitments that we've made to the rest of the world to negotiate in good faith toward nuclear arms reductions and nuclear disarmament, to pull nuclear weapons out of the day-to-day life of international affairs, make them, in a sense, impotent and obsolete by making them irrelevant to our military policies.
But is that really where we're headed? I mean, we've heard about the government wanting nuclear bunker busters, new nuclear weapons.
We're headed in exactly the opposite direction today, and I think it's a mistake. And it's a key part of the broader story that we're talking about here, in that, as Representative Shays was saying, if you're doing more in more places and spending more money doing it with this classified information and these nuclear materials, you're going to have a harder time keeping all of it under wraps and keeping it all secured. We're spending more today on the nuclear weapons program in the Department of Energy than we did during the Cold War, when we were actually facing a Soviet Union in an arms competition.
Not to mention, you're out there in the world talking with people in other countries where we would like greater nuclear security. What do the Russians say when you get on their backs about their security procedures? Are they pointing at Los Alamos as problems?
Absolutely. When you try to work with other countries to upgrade security at their sites, they say, who are you to talk to us? And yet, the reality is there's serious security culture problems in countries all over the world. In Russia, for example, the security manager at one of their biggest nuclear weapons facilities wrote an article a little while ago where he happened to mention that the guards routinely patrol without any ammunition in their guns so that they won't have any accidental firing incidents. They routinely have security doors propped open because it's more convenient.
Not too good if the Chechens show up with Osama's guys.
There used to be a big hole in the wall of one particular nuclear institute that I visited frequently that my colleagues used to go out and get lunch so they didn't have to go through all the procedures at the main gate. This is in Russia. These are serious problems, and they exist throughout the world. Good security is expensive, and it's inconvenient. And every dollar that facility manager spends on security is a dollar he didn't spend on something that's going to bring in some revenue. Every hour an employee spends following the security procedures is an hour he didn't spend on something that's going to get him promoted, get him a salary increase.
And even when you've got those dollars and those hours, as we see at Los Alamos, it still might not happen. Mike is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you.
Sure.
I've heard a couple of the guests tonight talk about consolidation as a way to try and help eliminate some of the security problems at different sites.
Yes.
However, one of the first things that struck me in the initial war in Iraq was a decapitation attempt by this country to try and take out some of the top leadership. I'm wondering, if you consolidate these capabilities, is there a chance that further on down the line, if we find a threat that has a different threat that might have ICBMs or something like that, we could have an issue with these resources decapitated with a single or several strikes?
If you put it all in one place, Mike, you've got a rough phone line, but we've got your point. Peter Stockton, how about it? If we're not going down Barbara's road and just getting rid of them, can we consolidate?
Time. And clearly that's the way to go. If you consolidate, it's much cheaper and much safer. We have probably the most secure facility in the world in the Nevada test site. It's called the Device Assembly Facility. And guess what? It's empty.
Because
we've been trying to move the material there. Shutting down TA-18 would save about $30 million a year. Taking the burst reactor out of Sandia would save about $30 million. All they protect is the fuel for the burst reactor.
Are you saying $30 million or billion?
No,
$30 million.
Oh, okay.
This is annually.
Yes, yes.
The $30 million that you'd be saving. And then another recommendation, and all of these are things that Secretary Abraham is you know, trying to move ahead with is de-inventorying Lawrence Livermore as well. I mean, they have tons of highly enriched uranium and plutonium that we believe they don't need.
But you hear our caller Mike's concern that if it's consolidated in fewer places or one place, it's then somehow more vulnerable.
Yeah, but we're not talking about the nuclear weapons that are part of our deterrent here. We're talking about those, the survivable nuclear weapons that are part of the National Nuclear Deterrent are on submarines, they're in ICBM silos. And that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is components, materials, weapons themselves that are off of missiles that are sort of in the pipeline within this vast nuclear weapons complex.
So the silos with the active ready weapons are all over the place. They're not consolidated.
Those are reasonably well secured against foreign attack of the kind that the caller is worried about. It's not really a concern about consolidating these materials. Peter is absolutely right.
And
we've got to get
these
things consolidated.
We're also talking about information, which is, it exists in at least two locations at two nuclear weapons laboratories, and also more than likely at the Department of Energy's headquarters in Washington. So
there's duplication right there.
Yeah, both on the materials end, and the
absolutely.
Component end, and the informational end. It's if we want to come back to kind of answering some of these core questions about why this seems to be such a persistent problem at Los Alamos. I mean, the folks from who are leading the laboratory right now gave a reasonable explanation, and all of the reporting I've done seem to back it up. I mean, basically, you have a couple of scientists out there who feel like they've got a deadline, and they're going to meet that deadline no matter what.
And a deadline for what, Ian Hoffman? For what kind of, product?
It'll be some type of a deadline for a weapons project.
I see.
I mean, the National Nuclear Security Administration gives these guys jobs to do, or they give themselves, their boss gives them a job to do.
And they want that next weapon.
Well, or they want to make sure that the weapon that you already have will go off as it's supposed to, at its rated yield, after it's aged for 25 years. I mean, there are a variety of things that these guys look at. Among other things, I mean, at other laboratories, like Sandia, they look at making sure that if a terrorist gets a hold of one of these weapons, that they're unable to detonate it without, somebody other than the president isn't able to authorize a detonation. I mean,
so security takes a back seat to that sort of pressure of the deadline to produce what they're expected to produce.
So these guys say, well, my job, is so important that I need to go ahead and get it done, and kind of the rules be damned. And that's why you end up having these guys kind of being slipshod with the rules. Does that result in kind of classified or, nuclear weapons secrets going willy-nilly out the back door? I mean, right now there's not any indication that this is, slipped outside of the laboratory and gotten into the hands of terrorists or a foreign power and so on. But here's the issue. I mean, you've got a laboratory here that's kind of full of its own sense of scientific hubris. These folks have been told that, they're the greatest laboratory on the face of the earth. The laboratory is about to roll out its own motto right now that says the world's greatest science serving America. And people have suggested, maybe that doesn't exactly encourage your rank-and-file scientists to kind of play by safety and security rules. And the other side of it is that they think that most people who promulgate those rules with the Department of Energy are basically D students who don't really kind of stack up intellectually. And so why should they listen to them?
Because they are the greatest scientists in the world, and yet, we've got to have security around that information. It's been a fascinating hour. I'm afraid we're out of time. But Ian Hoffman, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight from Oakland, California.
Thank you.
Ian Hoffman, staff writer for the Oakland Tribune, former reporter for the Albuquerque Journal, and co-author of A Convenient Spy. And Peter Stockton in Leesburg, Virginia tonight, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Peter Stockton, senior investigator at the Project on Government Oversight, and with me in the studio, Matthew Bunn, senior research associate at the Project on Managing the Atom at the Belfer Center at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. Terrific having you with us. Thanks so much, Matthew Bunn.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, a listen back to the first nuclear explosion in history 59 years ago today. This is On Point. We will end this hour with archival sound from the first nuclear explosion in history. On July 16, 1945, 59 years ago today, the fathers of the nuclear age gathered at the Alamogordo Test Range in New Mexico. Robert Oppenheimer, General Leslie R. Groves, Kenneth Bainbridge, and other scientists of the Manhattan Project were there. At 5:29 a.m., the bomb was detonated. Sand at the site turned instantly to glass. The 19-kiloton explosion ushered the world into the nuclear age. 8 days later, President Harry Truman issued the order to use the atomic bomb against Japan. But on July 16, only a select few were in New Mexico to witness history at the test site codenamed Trinity.
First in a test in the United States-New Mexico desert, then 5,000 miles away at Hiroshima, and then again at Nagasaki, came the world-shaking explosions of the atomic bomb.
General Groves, one of the officers in charge of the test, gives this eyewitness account. First, the burst of light of a brilliance beyond any comparison. Then a shockwave, followed by sound. A massive cloud was formed, surging and bellowing upward with tremendous power, reaching to the stratosphere in about 5 minutes. The cloud traveling to a great height, first in the form of a ball, then mushrooming, then changing into a long chimney-shaped cloud.
Everyone had become aware of the almost intolerable conditions which modern warfare, which total warfare, imposed on mankind. All over the world, people were looking for methods to ensure the peace.
Now, what about those people in the district for miles around who heard and saw? Today, residents of southern New Mexico, Arizona, and western Texas say that the explosion was felt like an earthquake in parts of those three states.
If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
He said, all at once, it seemed as if the sun had suddenly appeared out of the darkness. Then a great red glare. High in the sky, there were three tremendous rings at night. They swirled and twisted as if agitated by a great force. The glare lasted about 3 minutes. Then all was dark again.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
The world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Voices of Robert Oppenheimer, President Harry Truman, and others following the first nuclear explosion in history 59 years ago today at the Trinity test site in New Mexico. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Cora Peterson, Tim Skoke, and Ann Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.